Good evening, everyone, and welcome to part one of our Hilchos Nida review classes. It is our hope that this will be just the first part of a series of shiurim, at least one more shiur, will review the basic halachos of the area of Hilchos Nida. I want to focus this evening on one entire section, really the first issue which relates to Hilchos Nida, and that is how a woman becomes a Nida. Future shiurim will discuss some of the halachos that pertain to a husband's interaction with his wife and vice versa while a woman is a Nida, known as the harchakos. We'll also, of course, discuss in future classes how a woman goes from being a Nida to becoming Tahora, the issue of bedikos, checking herself, and then finally, if we have time as well, preparations for going to the mikvah and ultimately becoming Tahora. Before we mention the specific halachos that we will discuss this evening, it is of course important as a basic introduction to remind ourselves that the laws of Hilchos Nida, perhaps in a very concentrated way, are a metaphor for all of halacha and its interaction with Jewish life and Kedusha. By which I mean that we know that a halachic lifestyle, a Jewish observant lifestyle, is one which is very much anchored by and defined by halacha. And at the same time, we make sure, or we hope, not to lose sight of the forest for the trees. We understand that all of these details of halacha are not meant to just be nitty-gritty details, but also to create an environment of holiness and sanctity in our lives and in our homes. If this is true generally, it is most intensively perhaps, and certainly true, in part, when it comes to the laws in the area of Hilchos Nida. There are many, many halachos, many details, very complicated rules which regard all areas of Hilchos Nida. And at the same time, one cannot lose sight of the fact that the general area of Hilchos Nida is one which is very much a part of bringing holiness and Kedusha to our lives and specifically to our family lives. It's no coincidence that this area of halacha is known as Taharas HaMishpacha, the purity of the home, because it is these halachos which Chazal teach us, if properly observed, can bring Kedusha and Tahara to the home, and it is certainly therefore noteworthy that it's not just a burden, which admittedly it can be for the wife, for women, to have to observe these halachos, but it also is an incredible opportunity and is chus to be able to be the one, the instrument, who brings that Tahara and that Kedusha to the family. As I said, I want this evening's class to be about the basic question of how and in what contexts and what specific ways a woman can become a Nida. Just to give a brief outline of where we'll be headed, I want to break that down into two most basic situations which occur to women. Number one, when she gets her period. Number two, a woman who gets mid-cycle bleeding, or what we would call a spot or a stain, in Hebrew known as a kesem. And then I want to discuss three very specific questions. One, relating to a woman who gives birth, a yoledes. Number two, the general issue of medical procedures. And number three, the unique issue of a bride on her wedding night. So let's begin really at the beginning, and it is worth noting as a general background that there are two different parshios in the Torah which mention the concept of a woman becoming a Nida, or getting her period, or having her menses. Both are in Vayikra. The first one is in Perek Tesvav, and that, it's important to note, is in the context of Tumah and Tahara, the whole world of purity and impurity that relates, unfortunately, to a world lost to us, that of Kachim, of Taharos, of a world that was fundamentally connected to the Beis HaMikdash, when all of our lives had to be sensitive to the notion of Tumah and Tahara. And as we know, there are things, or many things, that could make someone, a man or a woman, Tameh. These are listed in the Torah. And one of them, the Torah tells us here in this Parsha, is that a woman who gets her period, or some of the other cases we'll be discussing tonight, could be in the status, or becomes in the status of a Tameh as she becomes Tameh. A few Parakim later, in Parak Yud Ches, also Sefer Vayikra, we have a second reference to the laws of Nida. And here, the context is one that is more familiar to us. That is in the context of prohibited relationships. Not only are certain men and certain women always prohibited to each other, but even man and wife, who are otherwise, of course, permitted to each other, but when the wife is in the status of nida, so then that becomes a prohibited relationship, actually a very serious one, punished by kares, if husband and wife were to be together in this context. And it's worth noting, as we will see, it will have a number of ramifications as we go forward in tonight's shir, to note that there are these two components, and while this, on one hand they're very different, we will see that even the laws of Tumah and Tara, the original mentioning in the Torah of the laws of Nida, actually can impact and can have echoes in impacting the laws of Tumah and of Nida when it comes to a relationship to husband and wife, which is of course the part that is directly relevant to us in our days. Another point of introductory basic information worth knowing is that as the Gemara and the Tur summarized for us, originally there was a two-tiered system of a woman's status when she would bleed. One was called a Nida, but there was another one called a ziva, where a woman could become a zava. These two statuses had different halachos when it came time to how much a woman would have to wait, how much time she would have to wait before she could go to the mikvah to purify herself. And this itself was somewhat complicated. An additional complicating factor was that we are told that originally there were five particular colors of blood that could create this tumah for a woman. Four different shades of red and black would make woman nida, but it took a particular expertise to be able to distinguish between these four shades of red and apparently other shades. And already in the time of the Gemara, we are told that this expertise was lost. As a combination of the fact that this expertise was lost, plus the two-tiered system of Nida and Ziva that I already mentioned itself was very complicated, the Gemara tells us already that the Benos Yisrael, or sometimes it's referred to by the name of Rabbi Zeira, but that basically the Jewish people took upon themselves to be machmir not only on all shades of red, but also to make a more normative system. And therefore, since otherwise it would have been too confusing, it was decided that we would be machmir and create a system that we're now under, where we wait the, quote, Sheva Nekiyim, the 7 clean days after any bleeding, even though perhaps on a original Torah level, some of the type of bleeding that we have might not have required that, but Benos Yisrael Hichmiru Al Atzman. In light of this, that is the status that we're currently working under, that in most contexts, if a woman were to get her period, no matter how long or when it took place, then she would be required not only to wait out the entire bleeding, and perhaps even some more days, that's a detail we'd have to get to in a subsequent shir, but then, as I said, wait an additional week, 7 clean days, before being able to go to the mikvah. Another important point of introduction is that there's a drasha that Chazal have, which teaches us, even though it's not obvious in the Torah text, but Chazal understand that what is being taught to us is that only uterine blood creates the halachic status of nidus, as opposed to other blood which may come from that area of the body, from a vaginal laceration or the like, or perhaps even from hemorrhoids or something such as that. Any other type of blood is not going to create the status of nida. And while we will get into some of those specifics later in the shir, and perhaps in a subsequent or following shir, it is worth noting, even at this early outset tonight, how important it is for women to recognize this, and the fact that there are times when they see blood, especially if it's not at a time of the month when they expected to see blood, it wasn't when they were expecting the period, where even though they may be unaware of some other condition, it is very much important to speak to a Rav, and usually with his consultation, have a doctor examine you so that it can be determined if there is an alternate source that we can assume the bleeding is being caused by, and thereby save you from becoming a nida. I can remember quite vividly a few years ago, a woman in the shul calling me that she was very surprised to be getting bleeding and spotting and staining at this time of the month. but there was no other explanation. She was quite confident that there could be no other explanation, and even though she was surprised, she was pretty much convinced that she was a Nida, and kind of was calling me to reassure her of that. But far from that, I cajoled her, and I have to say it took a while, but was able to finally convince her that she should have a doctor take a look. And I will never forget her call to me from the doctor's office in amazement that her doctor had in fact found an alternate source, something that she never knew she had, nothing serious, God forbid, medically, but a condition that she currently had, which was, according to the doctor, undoubtedly the cause of that staining. And while she was able, through the doctor, to quickly take care of that medically, at that moment we were able, Baruch Hashem, to resolve the halakhic question and preserve her tahara status. So that is just one of many examples that I and other Rabbanim have had, where sometimes women, out of the purest of motives, are inclined to be machmir on themselves, but very often through discussions with the Rav, and often in consultation as well with a doctor, we can find ways to be matir of the woman and preserve her pure status. And again, one of the reasons that sometimes happens is what I mentioned here, and that is that we have to know the source of the blood. It is only uterine blood which creates the status of nidus. Another issue to be aware of is the fact that from the original Torah perspective, the Gemara in Maseches Nida teaches us that even uterine blood per se will not necessarily create nida unless it is accompanied by what is known as a hargasha, or a sensation or a feeling that associates with the onset of woman getting her period. Now, it is worth noting that even though we are under the impression that nowadays women either do not have this or are unable to detect it, that does not necessarily mean that every woman who gets her period is no longer a Nida on a Torah level. Rabbi Willig, my Rebbe, and others have pointed out that perhaps this Hargasha is really meant as a simon, as a way of detecting the Nida status on a Daraisa level. But Ena Chanami, if there is a regulus, there's a regularity, there is a cycle, that may be the Daraisa as well. In terms of this Hargasha, however, getting back to that point, it's never defined precisely by the Gemara, and yet in an earlier Gemara, right in the beginning of Maseches Nida, it tells us that this was so strong, apparently, that it had the ability to awaken a woman at night, even though we don't know exactly what that is. And in the Rishonim and in the Poskim, the more recent authorities, there are generally considered three common theories as to what this is. Nevertheless, since we're not sure what it is, or even if women get it anymore, often the case is that absent that sensation, someone may be in the status of a Nida Midrabanan. I mention this to you because even though for all practical purposes when a woman gets her period, this won't make a difference, but this does explain a halacha which will relate perhaps more to some things we discussed next week when we get into the issue of bidikos, of woman checking herself as she goes through the process of either becoming tahora in the seven clean days, or if she's already currently in a status of tahara, but she wants to know because of some reason that she suspects a problem, she wants to check herself to be sure. So we have a tradition, we have a custom that many of you probably already know about, that the halacha is that if you find a spot on a batika cloth, a cloth that was inserted and very carefully checked, a woman checking inside herself, so we are very strict, more strict on such a spot than we would be if we would see a spot of blood in a different place outside of the body. And the general reason given, the Gemara alludes to this, and the Rambam talks about this, is because we're afraid, perhaps, that during the process of the bedika, while the woman is doing her internal examination, perhaps then she experienced a hargasha, the sensation, but she was distracted and her body was otherwise tricked, if you will, or misled, because when she thought she was just feeling her own bedika, her own examination, and really that masked or confused her away from realizing that she was getting a hargasha. It's worth noting that not only are we more machmir on cases of a bedika cloth, but although this will be far beyond the scope of tonight's shiur, it is worth noting that there are two other examples where the poskim are worried about the same concern, and that is right after urination, perhaps during that moment also it masked the feeling of hargasha, as well as when a woman is being intimate with her husband, where we are worried as well then that she was not aware of the hargasha, and therefore in those latter latter two cases, if a woman were to then notice a spot somewhat immediately after those actions, perhaps somewhere from 10 to 15 seconds afterwards, we may have to be very, very strict with such spots or even such bedikos. So that is just something to keep in mind, and if you're familiar with those stringencies, so then this is the explanation, this is the background behind it. I mentioned earlier that there is an issue of the color of blood or the color of secretion, which potentially is a problem or is not a problem. So to review in a little bit more of a comprehensive way, we mentioned that nowadays we are machmir on all shades of red, even though the Gemara originally said that it was only certain shades of red. And furthermore, black, which is most likely a more concentrated or dried red, we are also machmir on red or black. Now, it is worth mentioning, and this is something that I can, and I'm sure other Rabbanim can attest to with some regularity, and that is that we have to be careful, and women especially should be wary about paskening for themselves in such a case, or especially since they're going to be too machmer on themselves. There are many cases, which I am familiar with, in which something is just hard to explain any better than saying it's too red. An experienced Rav who has seen many cases can sometimes spot what is a red that is a problem, but also a red that is too red, if you will, to be the typical Dam Nida. And the truth of the matter is, more investigation needs to be done, because instinctively, when someone would see this, they would presume that they are Anida, that they are Tmeya, but very often a Rav who does some extra examination, whether it's by questioning the woman who brings the Shaila to him, or by other forms of investigation, which I'll mention in a moment, can actually be lenient in such a case. And as I said, the tip-off that there is something else going on may be not that it's red, but that it's actually too red. So, for example, a recent case that I know happened before a very prominent posek in America, where there was something brought to the Rav, and it clearly looked red, but a little bit off, almost too red. And in discussions in this case, it was the husband who brought the Shaila and was asked, well, what was your wife doing when she did the bedika, and I don't know all the details, but apparently the reference was to almost immediately or simultaneously with the bedika, the woman was putting on her makeup. And in fact, it was then determined, and the posek knew almost right away, that that must have been what happened, that some makeup got on either on the woman's hand, which then got on the cloth, or directly even on it. But that was an example where something was definitely red, but an experienced posek knew that it was too red to be a problem, and in fact was able to determine it, and in fact in such a case told the woman that she was okay. Another even more common problem, which I see with some regularity, and I'm sure other Rabbanim do as well, and that is when something looks, as I said, very, very red, and upon careful, very close examination, we can determine that in fact that not only is it not a Nida problem, but it's actually not blood at all, even though it may be mixed in with some other secretions, but in fact it may be a thread. A red thread is not an uncommon sight on undergarments or a bedika cloth. You may ask, where could a red thread come from? It's a good question. I'm not always sure. One possibility is it comes from some other clothing that somehow got brushed against, either the bedika cloth or the undergarment, and somehow latched on there. Another possibility when it happens on a bedika cloth is that these threads that are woven together to make the bedika cloth, as I understand it, I could be wrong, but I believe they're all bleached. There were probably other colors beforehand, and even if you bleach them strongly and accurately 99.99% of the time, if you do enough threads and enough bedika cloth, the law of averages is that it's somewhere, somehow, there's going to be a colored thread that gets missed, and that could also be the explanation. But be that as it may, whatever the reason is, we have all Rabbanim have seen this, that something that looks red, that a woman might want to be, assume she should be problematic, or an inexperienced rabbi, or even any rabbi, but just at first glance might think is a problem, but if one looks very closely, one has an eye for it, one can often detect that there is a thread. I remember when I was still learning in the yeshiva, and I was doing my training in this area, so one such undergarment came before my Rebbe, Rabbi Willig, and he wanted to show me and some of my other friends to demonstrate this, and in fact, we took out a microscope from the science lab, and we placed the undergarment under the microscope, and through the powers of the microscope, we were actually able to see quite vividly, because at that point, to my naked eye, I couldn't have told the difference, but through the microscope, we actually could see, you could see the spindles, you could see the twining of the thread. It was clear as day once you put it under the microscope. So sometimes you need to do that, and other times a rabbi gets enough of an experienced eye that he doesn't need even to do that, but it is quite clear, whatever the mysterious explanation for the source of the thread, it is quite clear that sometimes that happens, and therefore sometimes something that looks too red is in fact too red to be a problem. I would caution against anyone making such a determination on their own, but that's just another good reason why a shaila should be brought to a rav. Other types of colors which one tends to see either on a bdika cloth or under undergarments are white vaginal secretions, which are okay. There is quoted in earlier sources something like a green secretion. I myself have never seen anything like that, but it is quoted, and that is certainly okay as well. Another color which is tricky is the question of yellow. The poskim say that light yellow would be okay, as opposed to darker yellows, darker hues of yellow, which could be problematic. Since to the untrained eye, it's difficult sometimes to determine what is a light yellow and what is a darker hue of yellow. That is something that should be brought to the attention of a rav for his expert determination. And finally, on the question of orange stains or spotting, or something that may be brown, if it's really determined that it's orange or brown, the halacha is that it's okay, but again, this is something that should be taken to a rav for a shaila, so that it can be examined to make sure that it is not really too close to red or having some red in it. I have until now been specifically and most originally talking about a woman who is getting her period or sees something in the natural flow or even when she's doing a bedika. However, I also referenced the notion of other garments, and I want to now use that as a transition to a new area, or more explicitly, to get to the details of a new area of halacha. Namely, as I mentioned at the outset of the shir, there is a time where a woman gets becomes a nida because she is getting her period, and that, as you know, comes in stages and then lasts for any number of days. However, there is also true where a woman will spot or stain what's known in halacha as a kesem, or in plural kesamim, what would be known as mid-cycle bleeding. For a variety of reasons, this really should be okay. Certainly on a Torah level, this should not be a problem, because what's known as a kesem, by definition, according to the halacha, is something that did not have that sensation. There was no hargasha. A woman didn't feel that she was getting her period, but sure enough found a spot or a stain somewhere. So really, it should be okay. However, the halacha is that if you found such a stain, even without the hargasha, on clothing, getting back to the times of the Beis HaMikdash and when the Torah was originally envisioned, so then, even though a woman would not be prohibited to her husband, but from the laws of Tumah and Tara, getting back to the Beis HaMikdash, so the clothing would be Tameh. However, the Chasam Sofer explains, and this is how others explain as well, it was somewhat confusing or strange to separate these two halachos, to say that in such a case, a woman or the clothing is Tmeya, Tumas Nida, and therefore has the halacha associated with Tuma, but at the same time, the woman herself did not become a Nida to the extent that she is not prohibited to her husband. And therefore, because of that, what essentially became involved was that Chazal made a chumrah, midrabanan, that any kesem, any spot or stain would create a problem of Nida, midrabanan. Now, there is some distinction between when a spot is found on clothing, and when a spot is, or sheet, a bed sheet, on one hand, or on the other hand, if a spot is found on the woman's body. But we will limit our discussion now to when a spot is found on a bed sheet or a garment, because that is certainly the overwhelming likelihood of cases. Given the fact that this is a original and additional rabbinic prohibition, a chumrah midrabanan. So Chazal built into this chumrah, which is by definition a chumrah, as we said, from the Torah perspective, a woman should still be completely tahora. Nevertheless, since Chazal created this chumrah, they built into their chumrah a number of qualifications, four or five qualifications, which, without which, a woman, even if she sees a stain, would still remain, tahora, wouldn't become Tameya. So let's review some of those details now. In other words, we're talking about a case where a woman is has already come back from the mikveh, let's say. She's not expecting her period still for a little while, and then all of a sudden she notices a spot somewhere, whether it's on her clothing or on a bed sheet, something like that. That's the case we're talking about now. And even though from a Torah perspective there should be no problem, rabbinically there can be a problem unless you have one of these five conditions not being met. And if any one of these are lacking, then the woman remains tahora. So number one, the first thing to mention is that we paskin that the size of the stain or the spot is important. Only if the size is of a certain quantity, what's known in the halacha as kgris v'od. Gris is some kind of a little seed or some type of the size of a grain, which is in diameter in modern terminology about 19 millimeters, or we would call it, if you want to be simple, the size of a penny, a modern day penny. If the spot is that big or bigger, then potentially we could have a problem. But anything less than that, even if it's red like any other kind of blood and everything else looks like it could be a problem, but because it's smaller than this size, anything less than that, Chazal said, well, we could attribute it to some kind of a louse or bed bug, which used to be very commonly found, especially in beds, as I mentioned. And therefore, since it could be that a woman found this spot of blood, but it's because in her sleeping or something, she lied on one of these bugs and it got crushed and this is its blood, therefore or it was never included in this chumrah, anything smaller than that. Only if it was bigger than that, Chazal said we could be sure that it wasn't coming from this bug, but rather was actually from her body. Now, it's worth noting that not only is this a leniency, but as the Chasam Sofer writes, this is an especially big leniency, a big kula nowadays, when we don't have these types of body lice, and they're very uncommon, and we don't usually see these at all anymore. It's almost, in our day and age, it's almost an arbitrary leniency. Yet, Chasam Sofer, we have the right to rely on it, since this chumrah was made in specific circumstances. We have, in this case, fossilize the halacha, and in this case it benefits us because we keep the original halachos, the original details of the halacha, which require the kesem to be a bigger size than this, what's known as a kagris. So the first point to mention is if you have a spot or a stain, even if it's very obviously a problematic color of blood, and obviously blood, it still may be okay, it still may not make a woman anida if it's too small. Number one. Number two is that Chazal very much talk about in the Gemara Maseches Nida, what type of surface is the kesem found on. Since the original takana, as we've mentioned, was based on this idea of tumah and tahara, and we were worried about confusing the two, so therefore when Chazal extended the halacha from tumah and tahara to a woman's relationship with her husband, so then Chazal were only goes there, they only legislated if it was the type of kesem which was found on materials which could become tamei. Without getting into too much detail over these halachos, because they're very intricate and are well beyond just the issues of Nida, but when it came to the issue of Tumah and Tahara in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, so not only did you have certain materials which could or could not create Tumah, but if they were found on something, then it was only true, it only became Tameh if the type of garment or utensil had the status of being susceptible to tuma, what's known in halacha as being makabel tuma. But if something is not makabel tuma, then it doesn't matter what touches it or what got on it, it's simply impervious, it's not susceptible to tuma. So this is true when it comes to nida as well, and some common examples of this could be a plastic toilet seat. We assume la halacha that toilet paper is probably not makabel tuma. Pads that women sometimes wear as well, if they have secretions and other things which make them uncomfortable, Rav Asher Feinstein and others said was okay as well, because even though what looks like red, and we may know certainly that it's blood, we may even be worried that it's uterine blood, it doesn't matter because, again, where we found the blood is on a beged that's not makabel tumah, and one of the leniencies built into this general chumrah of spotting and staining of ksamim is that this second factor, not only is the issue of size, but also an issue of what material it's found on. If the garment or if the utensil is not makabel tumah, then it is not a problem. Number two. Number three, Chazal said that we're also not necessarily going to be machmir on certain color garments where the spot is found. This actually goes back to a machlokas in the Tanaim, the rabbis of the Mishnah. That debate follows through to the time of the Rishonim, where we question again whether the color of the garment makes a difference or not. Some are strict and say the color only matters to the status of the garment, but does not matter to the status of the woman who is the cause of the spot or stain, whereas the lenient opinion assumes that it also affects the status of the woman. And fortunately, we Paskin Lakula, we are lenient that depending on the color of the garment, it may be no problem whatsoever, no matter what color the spot is, meaning even if it's red, it's red, and no matter how big it is. We said before that the size could be an issue. But let's say you have a big enough spot, but it's on a colored garment, beged sivonim, as it's termed. So if it's on a colored garment, that was the subject of debate, no matter the size of the color of the stain, and we paskin lekula, that if it's found on a colored garment, no matter the color of the spot again, no matter the size of the spot or stain, if it's on a colored garment, on a colored beged, it is not a problem. Now, sometimes an issue which comes before me is what counts as colored. Sometimes people bring me things which are very light or pastel colored. So this is the subject of a machlokas in contemporary poskim. The Shevet HaLevi, Dain Wozner from Bnei Brak, is machmir on pastels, but most poskim are lenient even for light shades of color, a light blue or a light red and things such as that. There is a debate about shades of white, and just recently I had someone bring me something, a spot, and it was on a garment which was very close to being, I wasn't sure if it was tan or a shade of white, eggshell white or something like this, cream, and that is a big, big shiloh. There's a lot of poskim who discuss this question, and many, including my Rabbi, Rabbi Willig, are machmir on anything that has white as part of its name, and therefore I can only recommend that for bed sheets or for undergarments, one not have during the time of Tahara any type of off-white, cream white, eggshell white, or anything like that, because then you get yourself into a big shiloh. It is worth noting as a PS, so to speak, to something we mentioned before, and that was the issue of toilet paper. I mentioned that Rav Moshe or others say that toilet paper is not a problem because it's not makabel tuma. But there were those who were machmir on toilet paper per se. However, even according to those machmir shitos, even if one wants to be machmir for that, there were poskim who recommended that one use during this time of month colored, and we all know you can get blue, for example, toilet paper. If you use blue toilet paper, so then even if you don't have the leniency of Eino Mekabel Tuma, you would have the leniency of something being colored of Beged Tzivonim. One important point which relates back to the question of size is that the Poskim, Rav Moshe and others do note, and this is something that's very tricky, and I just recently had this as a discussion with two different people who came to me, that sometimes if the stain is so big that even if it's on a colored undergarment, which usually makes everything okay, but if it's so big, so then we're kind of worried that it's kind of crossed an invisible line from being a kesem, a spot, into something that really may have been the onset of a period just without the woman being aware of the hargasha. I say it's an invisible line because it's really an unscientific process, and that is sometimes a tricky issue which really needs to be handled by direct consultation between the woman and the rav. It is worth noting, even though I've been alluding to this, but I should, in the spirit of full disclosure, mention to you that the Chassam Sofer is of the opinion that this whole leniency of colored clothing versus white or shades of white is only talking about bed sheets or outer garments. But undergarments, something that's directly touching the body, the Chassam Sofer felt that this leniency did not apply. However, Moshe Feinstein and Chaz Nish before him, and the great Galatianer Chassidus HaPosek, the Maharsham, incidentally, the grandfather of the Magid, the famous Magid of Yerushalayim, who was named after his grandfather, the Maharsham. So they were all lenient against this Chassam Sofer and assumed that the colored garment had to apply even to undergarments, even to things directly touching the body. And in light of all of this, we understand that why the Ramah recommends, and this reflects an orientation that we have there, where we're not looking to catch women, we're not looking for women to become nida. If they become it, we have no choice but to accept it, but we try to do everything we can to avoid it, especially when it's not a woman's cycle. And therefore, we have the notion, and hopefully with this background you have a greater appreciation for it, that the Ramah already tells us that we encourage people to have colored bed sheets and colored undergarments during their time of Tahara, so that, that way, even if they do spot, no matter how big the spot, again, unless it's so big that we're worried that it's more than that, but therefore, no matter the spot or the color of the secretion, we can be lenient. That is the third issue. So we've seen that sometimes there's leniency based on size, sometimes there's leniency based on where it's found, if it's a makabel tumor or not, and finally, there's also an issue of the color of the garment or sheets where the spot is found. A fourth issue, which is a little bit trickier, which really can only be done with consultation of a rav, is the location. So if the tour mentions a simon kuf tzadik, that if the spot is found on a garment, and here we're talking about even if it's a big enough spot, and even if it's on a white underwear, for example, but if it's found in a spot where it's virtually impossible for it to have come from the uterus, and through, obviously, through a vaginal secretion, then we can be lenient as well. And this sometimes happens, especially if you know, for example, that someone is suffering from hemorrhoids. Again, sometimes this has to be done in consultation with doctors or other information, but sometimes if Rav will see a spot very much in the back of underwear where you know that it's almost, not, I wouldn't say definite, but it's almost definite or certainly very likely that it's not coming from a vaginal secretion but from somewhere else. So that is another way that one has the right to be lenient. Again, this is when we're talking about ksamim as opposed to when a woman is experiencing her period. So then it wouldn't matter where she saw the blood in terms of where it was found. A final issue to mention to wrap up this issue of ksamim, of spotting and staining, is the issue known as tlia. And that is, the Chazal tell us that even if everything else goes wrong, it's the wrong color, it's a problematic color, a problematic garment, and a problematic spot, and all those things, and a problematic size. But if we can have a tliya, if we have a very plausible explanation, an alternative source for the blood, so that we can be reasonably confident that it's not a uterine blood spot, but something else, so then we have a right to rely on that. And there is a certain latitude here, because again, we're only dealing with what at worst is rabbinic prohibition. So if we have a wound, for example, a maka, which is motziya dam, or at least maybe motziya dam in certain times of the month, that might be sufficient. So you have some kind of a wound, which could be the source of the kasem, the spot, then we can rely on that. Another explanation, which is really not as commonly helpful, but could be in certain cases, the Chazal and the Rishonim speak about, if the woman was working around blood. So, for example, if she worked in a butcher, or if she worked in a doctor's office, if it's possible that she got splattered with blood from some other source. In certain cases, maybe if there's a child with a bloody nose, or some other child with some other source of blood, again, each case has to be handled on its own, and thoroughly and honestly investigated. But if we can be tola, we can substantiate or suggest some other source of the blood, we have often the case a right to rely on that. So that wraps up the first big part of the shir tonight, and that, as I said, is the two most common ways a woman becomes a nida, either through getting her period or through what's called mid-cycle bleeding, or known as a kesem, a spot or a stain. We mentioned that that really is a big chumrah, and because of that, there are certain, about five different qualifications need to be met. If any one of them is lacking, again, I repeat, you need all five conditions in order to be machmir. If you are missing any of them, then you can be lenient on that kind of a spot. Again, these are good review halachos for you, but very often the case is that it's worth asking a shaila, at the very least, just if you're not sure, and also because, as many of you know, and as I try to tell women whenever I can, more often than not, a rabbi will be able to be makel for a woman in a way that she never thought. It's not always, I can't guarantee that every time you call me or any other rav, they would be able to makel for you. Of course not, that would be disingenuous. But it is true that more often than not, when women are surprised, they're surprised in the direction of being lenient, lakula, and don't regret having brought the shiloh to the rav. On the contrary, are very often pleasantly surprised that they can avoid being a nida when they thought they otherwise would be. I would like to mention now three other areas where a woman could potentially become a nida, or does become a nida, and some of the halachos that relate to that. The first I want to mention is, Baruch Hashem, when one has a simcha, when one has a, gives birth to a baby, what's known as a yuledis. So the halacha is that Yoledes, giving birth to a baby, actually creates the status of Nida automatically. What I mean by that is, theoretically, as the Gemara tells us, even if a woman gave birth without seeing any blood, we would still assign her the status of Nida. Now that is almost unheard of, but it illustrates the point that the status of Yoledes is independent. The reason that that is the case, that even without blood you would consider her Nida, is because, as the Gemara tells us, Masechas Nida and Chaf Aleph, a rule that we will see relates to the next question of medical procedures, but relates most obviously to a case of a woman giving birth, and that is the rule that Ein Psichas HaKever Below Dam. We assume that if the uterus opens, and especially if something comes out, in this case obviously we hope a healthy baby, so then we assume that even if a woman didn't see blood emerging from the vaginal canal, nevertheless there was blood, it's just that she didn't see it. And therefore we assume even if she didn't see any blood, a yoledes, someone gets birth, does become tamei. Now, from the Torah perspective, this is a little bit more confusing. Ironically enough, there are two different halachos. When it comes to a birth of a baby boy, a woman will be automatically tamei for 7 days, and if she had a baby girl, automatically tamei for 8 days. This, interestingly enough, was followed by periods known as Dam Tohar, namely that even if a woman saw blood after that, but any time after those days, for 33 or 66 days for a boy or a girl, respectively, a woman would be tahor no matter what, even if she saw blood. That's why it was known as dam tohar. Nevertheless, today, we consider all mothers to have the status of a ziva, as we've alluded to, and therefore we assume that a woman needs 7 clean days, a sheven, a kiyam, before she can go to the mikvah and become tahora. For all practical purposes, this really does become a moot point, because most women certainly bleed, just vestigial bleeding, after the birth for certainly longer than that, and therefore once a woman finishes bleeding after having given birth, then she would do the procedure which you're familiar with, Hesekara, the Bdikos, stuff that we'll review more in depth, I hope, next week, and then wait the 7 clean days, the Shevanikim, and then go to the mikvah. One point to mention, which is that, as you know, obviously, of course, sometimes tragedy strikes. Not long ago, in the last 2 weeks, I had this shaila where a woman miscarries. And the halacha is that someone who miscarries after more than 40 days of having been pregnant, they also have this status of yoledes and become Tameya. This is a particularly emotional halacha for obvious reasons, and sometimes if it's a very early miscarriage, there's a question of how long the baby had been alive for before the miscarriage, and sometimes we can be lenient. There used to be a system of determining the 40 days, but nowadays, in light of some of the more modern tests, it may be possible to even detect that more precisely, and that gives rise to new shilas that go beyond the scope of this lecture, this year. But if unfortunately this occurs to anyone, Rahman al-Islam, aside from all the other obvious questions that one might have in such a situation, but certainly there is a hechos nida shila which should be asked. I mentioned that a woman becomes, we presume that a woman who gives birth becomes a nida. Nevertheless, the poskim assume that the status of yoledes occurs sometime probably before the baby is actually born, and this gives rise to many shilas about when, during the birthing or labor process, a woman becomes a nida. Just to cite the basic shitos here, anyone who is in the process of being pregnant or soon to be expecting is encouraged to call me, and then I go through these halachos with husband and wife in more detail. But just as a review in the context of tonight's shir, there are a number of different positions. Rav Feivel Cohen, a contemporary posik in Brooklyn, some of you may know of, he is the most machmir. He assumes that when a woman's water breaks, if it does in the situation, which is not always the case, not even commonly the case, but sometimes a woman's water breaks before any of the actual labor begins, even without blood, even without any pain, he assumes that the water breaking probably included some kind of blood, even if he didn't see it, and therefore he thinks you have to assume that a woman is a nida already at that point. Many other poskim, including Rosh Hashanah Zalman Orbach, Rav Neubert, the contemporary posik from Eretz Yisrael, and the author of Shmir Shabbos Kol Chasa, Rabbi Willig, my Rebbe, Rav Avadji Yosef, and others, all disagree, especially if a woman does a bedikah after that, and it's a clean bedikah, that one does not have to assume that there was some invisible or missed blood or hidden blood, and therefore do not think you have to be machmir, but this is a shita that is out there. Another opinion that is sometimes quoted is that if the woman's mucus plug comes out, we know that that includes all sorts of things, including blood, in consultation with doctors, most poskim seem to be assured that even though there's blood there when the mucus plug comes out, that that is not uterine blood, and therefore one should not be machmir for that. Third and somewhat more accepted shita is quoted by, among others, the Shevet HaLevi, Rav Wozner from Bnei Brak, who says that once a woman is having contractions to the extent that she can no longer walk on her own or under her own power, that that may already be a point where even if she hasn't yet seen blood, we have to assume the psichas hakever, the opening of the uterus, and therefore we have to assume that there was blood even if you didn't see it, and therefore to be machmir. And finally, the most lenient position, and one which I generally paskin for women who ask me, is by Rav Vadi Yosef and others, and that is that really only once a woman actually sees blood as part of the labor, then you can you have to treat her as a nida, she becomes a nida, but before that one does not have to assume that there was blood that you didn't see, only when she actually sees blood on the birthing table. I move on now to another group of shilas, and that is the question of medical procedures. This is a question that I get commonly in different forms, and with good reason, because these are very complicated halachos, because sometimes there can be nidus without of the woman seeing any blood, and other times, just the opposite, even if a woman does see blood, she may not be a nida. So one way or the other, you cannot make any assumptions, and therefore if a woman has a type of gynecological procedure or medical procedure, she should certainly be in touch with her Rav to find out if that creates a nida problem. Just to do a little bit of basic biology, you may be familiar with this, but it's still worth reviewing because it'll help explain the different approaches that Rabbanim have when it comes to medical procedures. We've mentioned that blood that creates nida is known as uterine blood, as opposed to something that was coming from the vaginal canal or something like that would not be a problem. So the question is, what is considered the uterus from a halachic perspective? From a biological perspective, a uterus is really made up of two things. It's known as the uterine corpus, which is kind of like a pear-shaped part of the woman's body, which is approximately 6 centimeters long. This is what's known by Chazal as the makor, or Keber, and that is what is lined with the tissue known as the endometrium, which sheds, of course, on a monthly basis, creating a woman's cycle and her period. That is the uterine corpus. However, there is also something called the cervix, which is like the neck, so to speak, of the uterus, which protrudes down from it into the upper end of the vagina. Now, the cervix has two ostia, or openings. Ostia is plural for os. And basically, the two are known as the external os, which is the opening which extends or opens from the cervix into the vagina. And then there is what's known the internal os, and that is the opening that connects the cervix into the uterus. The reason I give you this biological review or background is because there's a major machlokes haposkim about the status of the cervix. Where or at what point is it considered halachically part of the uterus or part of the makor, from which we're worried that either A, if blood comes from it, it potentially could cause a problem, or more specifically, if it is in any way dilated or penetrated, that would constitute psichas pia makor, which we mentioned from the Gemara. If the uterus is opened, even if one doesn't see any blood externally, we assume that there's blood and have to be machmir. So in fact, this is a major machlokas, as I mentioned. There are some poskim who believe that the strict opinion has to be followed, and therefore any opening of the external os is already part of the makor, part of the uterus, as opposed to other poskim who believe you can be lenient and assume that it's really only higher up, only the internal os, which is the one that's directly connected to the, what you and I would call or were, is referred to more colloquially as the uterus, that is only there does the halachic uterus begin. And I want to clarify that according to all opinions, it would seem, any bleeding which can be confirmed as cervical bleeding does not constitute nida. And this is because even according to the strict opinion, even according to the Machmirim, even who hold that the external as is already the beginning of the halachic uterus, nevertheless, since the cervix has no endometrium, doesn't shed its lining, therefore the blood, by definition, cannot be uterine blood, and therefore it may be blood from the wall of the cervix itself, but that is definitely not uterine blood, and therefore if we could confirm that, all opinions are going to believe, not just the lenient ones, but even the general Machmirim are going to believe that you can't be lenient. If there is bleeding, as we mentioned, but it can be ascertained that it was caused by a procedure to the vagina or to the cervix, then she will also not be a nida. The question that arises is whether if there was no bleeding and the doctor says he didn't see any bleeding during the examination and there was nothing found on a bdika cloth or anything such as that, then we still have a shaila. As I mentioned, sometimes you could have a nida problem without any visual blood. And that is if we have somehow dilated or penetrated what's known as the piha kever. And this is where the machlokas that I mentioned comes up, because the question then becomes, if only the external cervix was penetrated, according to the Machmirim, you would have a problem, and according to the lenient opinions, you would not. So that really can happen potentially with any number of medical procedures, and that is going to be directly subject to the Machlokes HaPoskim. Just to give you a quick summary, there are opinions, as I mentioned, who are machmir, such as the Shevet Halevi or of Wozner, while many, many others, including Rav Moshe Feinstein, are makel. And therefore, we have a right to assume that only if a procedure penetrated the internal os would a woman become a nida automatically, even without showing any blood. And this is why when a woman has a medical procedure such as this, she should certainly try to get as much information as she can from her doctor and then be in touch with her Rav so that this information can be processed by the Rav and an accurate psak hopefully can be conveyed. Now, a final issue to mention, and this is sometimes not always appreciated, and it's good news because this is really the reason why most overwhelming majority of procedures do not create a nida problem, especially in cases where there would be no blood, is that the Gemara never says, when we talk about psichas pia makor, an opening of the uterus, the Gemara never says how big an opening that has to be. There are many, many shitos, and the terminology used is giving examples of perhaps different types of fingers, which of course we know very often is sometimes relates to even the way a doctor is doing the procedure. There are some shitos who are very lenient and hold it has to be open as wide as the width of a thumb. Others are very machmir that hold it has to only be open as much as the width of the little finger. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example, holds that as long as it's open less than the size of an index finger, it would be okay, but anything more than that is a problem, and that's somewhere in the rough area of about 19 millimeters or so. The reason that this is good news is because almost all modern instruments are not nearly that big. Most are anywhere between 3 and 12 millimeters, as I understand it, and therefore most cases, even if the cervix was entirely dilated, but if there was no blood, we don't view that as psichas pia kever. We don't view that as actual opening of the uterus, because even though it was penetrated, it was in a way that was too small. And there are times where a woman will have a doctor's procedure and she'll feel something going on, and there's a great hesitancy to do a check of oneself. There were opinions, and again, here the Shevet Halevi is one of them, who think that that is advised, but Rav Moshe Feinstein argues strenuously, and this would be my advice as well, that a woman should not do a bedika after an exam. If a woman does a bedika and finds blood, it may be okay, but it'd be very complicated, and more often than we would like, we may have to be machmir. As opposed to if there is no blood found in such a way, we don't, as I mentioned, we don't have to assume that there's blood, and even if there's spotting, we have more flexibility and more room to be makel. So that is something to keep in mind. There are, as you know, virtually endless different types of procedures and instruments that doctors use. Therefore, most of them should be brought as a shaila to the Rav. Just to mention two very common issues which come up, which are both lenient. One is the speculum, which is used to separate the vaginal walls to help the doctor do his examination. A speculum is not a problem. And number two, a common shaila that I get as well is a pap smear. And a pap smear, we assume, is also not a problem. Only about half patients, as I understand it, only about half patients who have pap smears even see bleeding. And as a pap smear is really just a result of, or the way it's done is brushing of the external cervix or the cervical canal, that blood, as we mentioned already ahead of time, that blood itself is not a problem. And since it's incredibly unlikely for the smear or the brushing to penetrate the internal os, you don't have to worry, no matter what the size of the instrument would be, you don't have to worry about it creating a problem. So again, just to review, when it comes to medical procedures, if there is bleeding or spotting, then certainly should be shaila should be asked, because that may be a problem. It may not be, but it may be. We'd have to ascertain where the blood comes from. But that's one issue of halacha. And a second one is that there are certain procedures which potentially could create a nida problem even if there's no blood seen. However, it is good to know that that is rare and far between. But to be safe, of course, Rav should be consulted. And a final piece of advice is, of course, that whenever possible, both with your schedule and the doctor's, best to schedule this. It's not exactly when the period is occurring, but as close to after that as possible, so that even if the procedure creates a nida problem, it does not extend the amount of days that month that the woman is nida by too much, as opposed to if it's when a woman was supposed to be tahora, and then she has the medical procedure. Certainly, if that would create a nida problem, that would be far more devastating than if it was during or right after a process of getting her period. One final issue to mention, which is obviously only relates to people in a unique situation in their lifetime, but one which may be relevant to anyone either here at the Shir or someone who has a relative or a daughter that this may go through. Just to mention that unique but connected to everything we've seen is the issue of a bride on her wedding night. Even though we may be absolutely positive that that blood is not uterine, and I have stressed until now throughout the shir that only uterine blood creates a problem, nevertheless, the Shulchan Aruch quotes that we have a chumra mirabanan for what's known as dan besulim, or hymenal blood. And this is a double chumra, namely, if on the wedding night, woman chasan and kala see some blood, even though we know it's not uterine, it's damasulim, it's hymenal, nevertheless, we're still machmir. And a chumra upon that is that we are machmir even if you don't see any hymenal blood, which is actually the far more common occurrence nowadays. Most brides do not have that type of blood or bleeding, but it doesn't matter. We assume that if there was a full act of bia, a complete penetration between husband and wife, then that could create the special status of a dam basulim, of a bride becoming a nida. Of course, there are a variety of reasons, and it's more common than people might expect, that that may not occur on a wedding night, and a chasan and kala should hopefully be taught, especially the kalos, but the chasanim as well, that not only is that not uncommon, but if they're at all unsure, as delicate and sensitive as shaila as it is, it really should be asked, because potentially that could make a very significant difference in what happens to them in that day and those days immediately following their wedding. I hope this shir has been clear, and I hope it has been comprehensive. As I mentioned, all of this is still really only one part of Hilchos Nida. This is all about how a woman becomes Nida in these various circumstances. What we have left to try to accomplish in a following shir are ways in which a woman can become Tahora through the Bedikos, preparing for the Mikvah, as well as some of the Halachos that govern interrelationship between men and women, husband and wives, known as the Harchakos, while a woman's in her status of Nida and not yet having gone to the Mikvah. I hope everyone has enjoyed and benefited from the shir. If anyone has any further questions, I can be reached by phone at 410-358-8604, or you can reach me by email at rabbigottlieb@shomreemunah.us. And if someone would prefer even more anonymity, they can email the question to our office manager, Helen Helmert. Her email address is office@shomreemunah.us, and she will be able to anonymously forward me that email. If you do have any shilas and you convey them to me indirectly by email, please indicate if you'd like me to respond to you directly, or you would like me to try to incorporate, if I can, answers to those questions in the beginning of next week's share. Have a good night, everyone, and thank you for listening.